in a larger sense, just the impact of all the different impact that technology is having on people and cultures
We find that our position is a very unique one. You know, we are a big band. We have access.
You've got enough money to do whatever you want.
Yeah, we have technology. We've access to the airwaves, be they TV or radio or whatever. That I think most visual artists, it's like a dream for them. And we're actually kind of at this point in time, we're a little bit more relaxed about being a big band because we've turned it into part of, you know, the creative process. We're actually using our position in a way that, you know, it gives us a certain amount of amusement, and it's turned it into part of what we do. Instead of, I think a few years ago, we were a little bit more almost uncomfortable with the idea of being a big band. You know, it seemed like maybe coming from where we did and, you know, being interested in the things that we were interested in, it seemed like a bit of an anomaly, a bit of a contradiction.
Was it like trying to reconcile what you were trying to do when you started and what music was to you then, and then look what it's turned into?
It was so different, you know, like when we started out, it was like we were very influenced by obviously the 76, the whole punk thing.
Yep.
Of, you know, Start Again, Wipe the Slate Clean, and, you know, Vitality was where it was at, and no one was really thinking very much. It was really about just making the statement. Now,
you've become
very big.
In a way, you've become if you were to look at the equivalent, it's like you're the next big thing that a bunch of kids could say, you know, tear that down because we want, you know, what's the next thing coming up?
Sure, yeah.
I mean,
I think that's part of the whole regenerative thing of rock and roll, and I think that's really important. But, you know, all those bands coming up, you know, we were that then, I suppose.
Yeah.
You know, now we're in a position where we are big, and we want to do something with this position that's interesting and that's imaginative and that, I suppose, is the right amount irreverent. And, you know, we're not taking our position seriously in that sense. We're actually, in a way, I suppose, being kind of subversive and just manipulating it. And the whole Zoo TV thing and the access that being where we are gives us has given us a lot of enjoyment. You know, we're playing around. We got TV specials coming up, which are really hilarious. We did this satellite link up through MTV where we beamed our show into somebody's front room, and you know, the possibilities are only beginning to present themselves.
Well, one thing that I've been curious about is, I mean, I think what you're saying sounds great. You know, if you're able to get to a position where you've got, you know, the power, the money, and all that to do something and still maintain this idea of, you know, let's keep exploring and let's keep doing something interesting, fun, it's really great. But it seems like when you get to be a certain size, I mean, you're like, you know, you're an international cultural phenomenon, and it seems like a lot of what you're doing, if you were to really look at it and analyze it, you'd say, well, that is pretty subversive, that's real interesting, but it ends up being lost on such a huge number of the people who are following what you're doing, because they're sort of more following it as a surface thing, you know, what's the new top 40 hit from U2 or whatever.
I mean, yeah, well, we have to accept that.
I mean, I don't know if that's just something you just realize, and that's just part of what it is.
Yeah, I mean, we're not shy about being big anymore. You know, I think rock and roll should be big, really. I mean, it's about mass communication. You know, it's like the idea that it's kind of a cult thing and that it's underground is all very well, but it's a shame if that's all it ever is. That, you know, the majority of the airwaves are dominated by music that's really purely commercially motivated and does not go beyond that. That it's essentially one-dimensional.
One thing,
you know, we're in a position where we can do some more wild things, and I would think it would be a shame if we just accepted the standards and the way that most bands go about their business and didn't use this position in a different way.
I wanted to ask you something more about the Zoo TV tour. One thing that I had read, but it was never really clear to me if this was actually happening, was that you had a satellite dish. Is that right? So that
yeah.
you could take stuff down live
yeah.
off of the various television transmissions around the world.
Yeah, we've essentially the system is it's like we got the big screens on the stage, which are the final, you know, image that's created. Down by the mixing board, we've got a vision mixer, which mixes in, blends the images from live cameras, from optical discs, and from live, satellite transmissions that are taken in from a dish outside the venue. And so the combination of images can be any of those sources. We've incorporated telecommunications. We've got a telephone on stage. The Bono occasionally makes calls from the stage, occasionally calling the White House or ordering pizzas or whatever. Phone sex. I mean, it's really about.
So you can kind of sample whatever's out there in the airwaves.
Yeah, it's kind of like information central, and whatever that is, whatever kind of.
One thing that I've been just curious about, there's been lately, at least in the some of the music press I've been reading, there's just more and more controversy over copyright issues.
Yeah.
And sampling, and I thought one thing that you were doing in the Zoo TV tour is that you were taking the television broadcasts are copyrighted material that you're just rebroadcasting right there in a venue where people paid a ticket price.
Yeah.
And I wondered what you thought about that.
And whether you had any problem, whether it ever came up that was, you know, illegal or
something. No, I haven't heard. I mean, I asked the question early on, is this going to be a problem? And apparently I don't think there is a problem. I mean, in theory, I don't have a problem with sampling. I suppose when a sample becomes just part of another work, then it's no problem. If sampling is, you know, stealing an idea and replaying the same idea, but changing it very very slightly, that's different. So what we're using the visual images in a completely different context, and if it's a live piece of live broadcast, it's like a few seconds at the most. So there's very little, I don't think in spirit there's any.
So you would say
have any real cause to be upset.
So you would say like a fragmentary approach is the way to.
Yeah, go. Yeah. You know, like in music terms, I mean. You know, we sample things. People sample us all the time. I hear the odd U2 drum loop in a dance record or whatever. You know, I don't have any problem with that.
And well, this is interesting because we've been involved in a situation similar along these lines.
In fact, maybe it's time for me to interject here. Hi, this is RU again, and. The folks that you've been talking to, Don and Mark, aside from being occasional contributors to Mondo 2000, are members of a band called Negative Land.
Ah.
And I figured we could. I know they've been sued by your record label, but they haven't been sued by you, so I thought that we could engage
in a
conversation. You sound like a really great guy, and I don't want you to feel like we're out to. To surprise you or sabotage you, but just to engage in.
No, actually, I was going to say something at the very beginning, but then we got right into the conversation, so I didn't get to say it. But
anyway, we were sued by Island for a very fragmentary sample of one of your records.
And, yeah.
And gee, we were terribly offended by that.
Sorry, I didn't catch the last bit.
Oh well, it's just the thing that happened, I guess, was that happened to us was that with Island was that. you know, we ended up actually sending some packages stuff along to you and some letters, and I don't know what kind of communications you ever got about it. But, you know, we did.
Yeah, well, I mean, from what I can remember, I can't remember the exact sequence of events, but as it was presented to us, you know, here's the record, here's the album sleeve. Ireland are already on the case here, and they've objected because they feel it's because of the artwork that this is at a time where a lot of people are expecting the new U2 record, and they felt that from their own point of view, in a pure business sense, nothing about art. I just think they thought that there was a chance. A good chance that a lot of people would pick up the record in the record shop and think, oh, this is a new U2 album.
Well, that actually was, in the context that you're in, you have an idea of doing something that's subversive, and we're scurrying down, way down low in the underground of music, and we're doing things that we also think are somewhat subversive. I actually have always liked the music that you do, and I think you can tell from, you know, I listened pretty carefully to a lot of the stuff you guys have done, and really think especially the new record's terrific. But the thing that we did was, you know, the lawsuit from Ireland dealt with this as if it was a consumer fraud that was intended to rip off innocent U2 fans, and that we were going to somehow make millions of dollars by selling these records. And of course, it didn't acknowledge that there was any, they may not like the artistic intent of the record. You know, maybe even the members of the band might be offended by what we did, but no one ever in any way acknowledged that the record was anything else. And yet, actually, when you look at the cover, when you listen to the record, look at the whole package, I mean, there's a U2 spy plane on the cover and stuff. It's pretty obvious that this is actually a work, you know, an artistic statement. Again, you may not like it, but it's a statement about something.
I didn't have any problem with it. I think Casey Kasem got a worse deal than we did. No, I mean, the problem really was that by the time we realized what was going on, it was kind of too late. And we actually did approach the record company on your behalf and say, look, come on, this is, you know, this is very heavy, and
they shouldn't really
have got this serious. But at that point, on a point of principle, their attitude was, well, look, okay, we're not going to look for damages, but we were not about to swallow our own legal costs. The way it ended up was that what they were looking for were costs, not damages.
Right. But it's kind of assuming, I mean, what happened, the other thing that happened was that we didn't get a phone call from Ireland saying, look, we're pissed, we don't like what you did, you know, our band has a new album coming out, and you better pull this thing or we're gonna smash you. They didn't give us any chance to do anything. The first thing we heard was 10 days after the record was out, there's a 180-page lawsuit.
Wow.
So it was kind of like there was no negotiation, and they went ahead and were spending their, you know, they've got $400 an hour lawyers, right?
See, you're quite right about their main concern being the cover rather than the content. We always felt that, and I think that was obvious from their lawsuit, too, the way it was worded. But they never, which they could have done so easily, they never came to us and said, change the cover.
Yeah.
And instead, they just smashed the whole thing, including the content, which is really a shame, I think, because
we were naive because we were a little worried about Casey Kasem, but we thought, look, we thought we're a tiny infinitesimal band. We sold 5,000 copies of a record, 10,000, and we thought, I had the distinct impression that U2 had actually a sense of humor, and that sometimes someone coming along and taking the piss out of them a little bit was something that they would just perhaps really just find kind of amusing, and that
the thing is that I think we would have reacted in a completely different way, but unfortunately, it wasn't, the lawsuit was not our lawsuit, and although we have some influence, we weren't in a position to tell, you know, Iron Records what to do.
Well, that's the thing that we were always wondering. We said, you know, is that really true? We said, okay, if U2 sells 14 million copies of an album for a label, and they're the main, you know, they're the main thing that keeps Island Records in business economically, then don't the artists or or is it, or in fact, do they not? I mean, wouldn't you would assume from our position, you could see how we would think that you would certainly have the leverage to.
Why can't the artist have more influence over the label? Do you know?
What may have happened is that theirs was a knee-jerk reaction.
Yes.
At a moment when they were expecting the album to be delivered, and they were probably, you know,
and though you may find this hard, to believe.
Maybe after the event, you know, they were way down the road before they really took a proper look at what it was. But I think they felt.
Well, you know, we've had contact with Island throughout this and continuously trying to get them to adjust their position or pull back or not go any further, and yet actually they did keep on this right up to the point of...
Well, yeah, one of the things that we tried to make clear, actually, too, and we sent some faxes to Eric Levine and Chris Blackwell and Paul McGinnis, is we said, look, you know, it's one thing, you know, we could have changed the cover, that's one thing. Or we could have even stopped making the record, and we would have had to, you know, the band would have had to pay for the costs of destroying the copies that are still in the warehouse. But then what happened, of course, was they went after not only all these records that have to be destroyed, but then they went after the damages, and we made it very clear to Island and to Paul that that our label was going to turn around and come after all that money out of us, that in the end, Negative Land would pay for absolutely every cent of it, and that, you know, it's $90,000, which, you know, you may spend $90,000 on ordering a pizza at a show for your fans, but for us, we haven't made that much money in 12 years as a band, right? So it was like, there's a difference between, you know, sort of putting a stop to something or smashing a tack with a sledgehammer.
I know.
And that's the thing that we were trying to communicate, and, you know, that it's...
Well, listen, when we heard this idea that you and SST had fallen out and that this was going... was no longer record company to record company problem, that it was like you were losing the money. So we actually...
Because we offered to...
We got some message that you wanted the records given back to you. And I mean, I was up for that. But then I heard that Casey Kasem was not, that he was actually wanted to stop it. So
that's the latest word.
I don't know. It's all become a big mess.
That's the latest word. But we actually, we wrote to wrote to Casey, and his attorney said no way.
Well, the thing that was interesting about Casey was that Casey in public was questioned about the whole single, and he said, "Well, I don't like what they did. It's embarrassing to me, but I'm for free speech. I'm against censorship. I'm for the First Amendment, and I think people should be able to do what they want." And then privately, he said. He said, "No, I'll sue your ass if you try to put it out." And so the thing that's been interesting to us in this whole thing is that we were working for a record label that was very much outside the mainstream music industry. So we're dealing with SST, with U2, with Casey Kasem, they're all people who, you know, we're really looking at what people's public persona is versus private.
Yeah.
And it's been real interesting, and it's what we've been, of course, always wanting to somehow have some contact with you too to find out, you know, what really happened.
Right.
Because my feeling
you should have tried to make contact first. You know, maybe not even with
can't
us.
Get to you.
But that's the thing is you
can't do that.
You are insulated behind so many layers of management and
yeah.
And I mean, we contacted Warner Chappell Publishing about possibly even sampling clearance rights, and we were told no. You know, U2 simply just never grants that. It's not done.
Oh, that's complete bollocks.
Okay.
I mean, there's at least six records out there that are. Direct samples from our stuff.
But they may not have been granted by Island.
Well, they must have been, because some of them, like there's a thing called New Year's Day, which is a dance groove basically around the New Year's Day bass part and drum part. So, I mean, that's actually not just a sample.
The other feeling that we had, which we were kind of talking about earlier when we were talking about the Zoo TV tour, was we said, look, you know, a long time ago, artists always react to their environment, right? You're always doing something that's reacting to the world you're in. So what are the tools or the technology you had a few hundred years ago? Well, maybe you had a paintbrush, you had a piano, a lute. You could interpret things that way. And the way we see it now, and it sounds like perhaps you agree, is that now the technology is simply different. And now it happens that instead of just making a painting of something, I can take a photograph, I can make a Xerox, I can make a sample.
It's capturing.
Yeah. And you can capture it, and that's our environment. You know, our environment is, you know, and it's something that you're suggesting in the Zoo TV tour, too. The environment is this media-saturated thing that we live in. And to us, it was like, on the one hand, I know that, in fact, you two is a bunch of guys trying to make some music, music. And but at another level, you two is part of the media environment I'm in. You know, I hear your songs, you know, it's playing in the shopping mall in the background when I'm shopping.
Yeah.
And so for us to ask permission to do something that's in response to the environment we in, which is something McGinnis said to us very early on, was, oh, you should have asked us. And we sort of felt like, well, you know, that isn't, from a business standpoint, there's one way, but from an artistic standpoint, we felt that no, you know, we don't need to. This is just the world that we're in.
See, we also, your response to sampling is the absolutely correct one, I think, which is, if it's fragmentary, it's okay. No one should,
and if it recontextualizes,
no one should really worry about fragmentary appropriation of anything, because it just should be, you know, the public domain is actually literally the public domain, and if it's in it, let's use it. And, you know, we're against bootlegging entire works and all that completely. I mean, that is ripping off people. But this, the idea that all this stuff is out there surrounding us and we're swimming in it, the idea that it could become part of your work, I think, is perfectly appropriate and, in fact, necessary as a kind of self-defense against the coercion that media has become. And yet, the business end of it, your label and every other label, has an archaic view of this based on their own ownership of all that culture.
Yeah.
And so part of what we're about now, especially since our own lawsuit, is to sort of bring all this out in some way. And even to the point of changing the copyright laws, which is what I'm on to right now, I would really like to relook at the copyright laws in this country and the way that you can't even sample, you know, 2 seconds of something because it's owned, I think is totally wrong. And has to be changed in this age of new technologies that are basically about capturing things.
Yeah, well, technology has really paved the way for this because...
Yes.
We're in a new era. The technology is the means to create in music.
But the laws have not caught up with that at all.
Part of the industrial scene that you were mentioning earlier is capturing, and the idea of appropriation is very much part of the sort of the cyberpunk thing that Mondo 2000 is associated with as well.
Right.
We're in a funny position here because you called us and then it was the first opportunity for Negative Land to talk to you guys.
But I wanted to hear what Edge had to say because I think that the larger issues are really interesting.
Yeah,
absolutely, yeah. I mean, ultimately, it does no one any good if creativity is stopped, you know, because record companies are losing money. I suppose the fine line is between where a sample or, you know, using somebody else's work is pure theft and plagiarism and where it becomes a legitimate new thing. Mm-hmm. And that's, I suppose, that is where whatever new legislation...
Exactly.
That's a sticky thing.
That's where it's really going to... It's difficult to
I think
to
it's
be
akin,
clear.
It's going to be akin to deciding whether something's pornographic or not. It's going to be the same kind of tricky definitions there. But I've come to the conclusion that actually I would make the defining guideline in the law whether or not it's in effect a bootleg of a complete self-contained performance or whether it is a fragment, any part. And to me, I would just say using any part but not the whole is okay. Now you'd get to the point where someone would exploit that and use everything, use all but the last 10 seconds of a song and say, okay. But that's a case for the judge to say, no, you're really just pushing it there, and that's wrong. Like pornography, they can make a decision about that. But to me, I would like to see the law say any fragmentary use of another person's work is free, abs- absolutely free, and they don't have to pay royalties, and they don't have to pay rights, and they don't have to get permission. They can just use it because it's there.
Yeah, I would be up for that.
And that would just be part of working in the public domain, you know. If you're going to be a public person and put things out, that's, you can make all the money you can off your own work, but you don't control it to the extent that no one else can make any use of it, you know. That's what I would do.
I mean, I know of dance records that, you know, I've heard them in clubs on cassette that can never be released because the bills that would have to be paid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean,
it's true with us, too.
If you list, I mean, there's no reason for you to be familiar with any of our other work, but we've been doing stuff using bits of, not so much music really at all. Actually, the U2, the Negative Land thing we did with U2 is actually one of the only times we've really used a lot of someone else's music, and it was because it was part of the concept. But we've always used lots and lots of voices from radio and television and you know, recorded out on the street and found in record stores and we realized the way that we work, I mean, we literally on our record we have hundreds of different little bits of voices all put together, and if we even had, you know, how could we take the time or ever have the money or the ability to find out where they're all from and pay everybody and so it's as if and what's happening lately now, I guess, with all the labels are becoming even more scared about sampling and infringement. Yeah. It's like they're totally clamping down on a whole way of working.
They're all caving in, absolutely caving in. Anytime a lawsuit comes up, the label apologizes and capitulates and says we're sorry, and you know, no one is fighting the law, is saying that the law itself is unreasonable at this point.
Yeah. Well. I don't know what to say, really. I mean, I'm only interested in the spirit of what it is, not the legality.
Yeah,
I don't even know fully what the legal side of it is. But
here's the thing, though. You are hooked up with the legality. You are in partnership with someone who is taking an opposite point of view. And I'm wondering, what the hell can you do with your influence and your power as a group to affect some changes? Because this has destroyed us as a band. We are absolutely now with no label. And with no money, and with no opportunity to put out anything else because of this lawsuit.
One thing that's happened is that our label now is turning around and is taking the royalties from every record we've ever done, so we're not making the last, like, 7 years of work is down the drain. There's no money, there's nothing. And we offered to split the losses with our label 50-50, and they wanted us to pay 100%, and we said, you know, we think that that's just morally and ethically wrong. You put it out, we made it, and that's why we quit. We didn't quit over business. We quit over, for us, what was an ethical and moral choice, and now they're turning around, and they're going to sue us. So it's like the, you know, the... And of course, I mean, Island isn't responsible for what SST Records decides to do, but we were making it clear all along in letters to Levine and Blackwell, like, look, this is the repercussions of what's happening, and do you want to be in the position where this is, you know, what you're doing? Because you're not just stopping a record, you're actually, to a large degree, you're economically destroying a band. So...
And like you say, the really stupid thing is that it was done. It was done about the cover, but they succeeded in crushing art. They didn't seem to know the difference or care about the difference.
Yeah. What interests me then is whose responsibility is the cover? I mean, you provide the music, but
we did the cover.
He released it in that cover.
We designed the cover, and it's true. We were very naive, and we were trying to actually make it look like a U2 cover to an extent. They're absolutely right on that count. It is a deceptive practice, no doubt about it. And we wouldn't have argued that, and we would have changed the cover if they'd asked us to. But they never did. They never even asked about that. They have this sledgehammer approach, which is based on being so big and so rich that no one can fight them, and that's exactly what they did. They threatened us to go to court. We couldn't afford to go to court. So actually, it's just a question of money winning, not points, not you know, no principles. It's just they had more money to waste than we did, so they could win, and that's what they did. That's what really bothers me about this, is that the whole art, the whole issue of the content and the integrity of the art and the integrity of the idea that free speech is part of should be part of art, and that no matter how offensive it should be able to be out there none of that it was able to even be brought up because they didn't like the cover, so they squashed the whole thing as if it was all the same, just a matter of money.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're dealing there with a company, you know, that is their thing. It is about business. And as it happens, Chris Blackwell is a great supporter of you know, young bands, and you know, he generally would be on your wavelength. So I mean, I can't speak for Chris because although I read his letters, I didn't speak to him personally about it. But
I got the impression
it just
didn't
to understand quite why he jumped where he did.
Yeah, I don't either. And I got the impression that even after we had explained some of this to him, it didn't make any difference. They committed, the wheels of rolling, the paperwork's been
done. I had the feeling that it was like some executive made the decision, and once it's decided, that executive couldn't lose face by turning around and saying, oh, I guess I made a wrong decision there.
Yeah, it's a typical bureaucratic mishmash there. But here's my point, is like, here, artists are hooked up with these people, in my mind, unfortunately, and so how is this, how do you correlate the, you know, your attitude, which is about the spiritual imperative of music, basically, and the company's attitude, which says, oh yeah, that's fine, and then actually I think they sort of interpret that idea, or just...
We got cut off this.
Oh, thanks for calling back.
All right, good points for you.
Oh, so I was making the point about the artist and the company and how they're inevitably linked up in the way that the business is set up, and yet their motives and their priorities are completely, to me, opposite. And how do you reconcile that? I mean, do you just say, well, we really can't control that, or why the heck can't we say, you know, I'm going to try and control that. I'm going to try and get in there and have some influence and change that attitude and have some effect.
This has never come up, you know. I mean, obviously there's a conflict there, but in the way that you set up your dealings with the record company, you protect what you think is important and you leave them to take care of the aspects of their business that they need to be in control of.
Yeah, but you see what happened now. You see what's happened.
You protect the thing that... You protect yourself and your own, what you're trying to do, but, you know, we've never until now felt like we had to also be in control of situations that didn't involve us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's never come up before.
Well, one thing is that, again, the sheer size of your group and the scale at which you're working means that just to be able to function day to day, you've got to have a lot of different people working for you. And I assume that Paul McGinnis is a big part of kind of filtering things out and communicating what he thinks you need to know and keeping out what he thinks you don't.
There is a bit of that, but
I think there's a lot of that.
It seems like, yeah. I mean, it seems like that. I don't know. There could be more layers around than you can realize when you're in the middle of it. I don't know. I mean, from our perspective, trying to get through to you and all that stuff.
Can't be done.
It was made out to be, Blackwell and McGinnis were acting as if this was a simple thing. You know, why didn't you just do this or do that? And it was like, well, it, you know,
it's
not.
Well, to be fair to ourselves, I mean, we do spend hours and hours dealing with requests and connections that have been made.
Mm-hmm.
So we do see most things that come into the office.
Well, that's good.
If we're not in town, obviously we don't. But
yeah.
I mean, I think if you had made a direct approach, I'm sure it would have come to our attention.
Well,
I know something like Negative Land, it would have need to have been pitched in it to some way for us or for any of our people really to fully understood what was going on. But I'm sure, I've no doubt that if you had made a direct approach to Paul McGuinness or to our office, that we would have come across it, and that it would have been, you know, would have got to us.
Yeah. Well, as I said, I mean, that certainly is one legitimate way to do it. But then, as I was saying earlier about what I spark and the environment and the new technologies and all that stuff, I was saying.
What if you went to Island and you said, from now on, I want you to let anybody sample our work for nothing who wants to. What do you think they would say? They would say, no, what do you think they would say?
Well, I'm not sure we can make a judgment like that. You know,
it's your music.
The deal that we have is that we sell or we rent the use of the copyrights to somebody else. That's the whole idea of having publishing and recording deals. So
right. It's like you're licensing it to them?
They have the right to exploit our work.
Right. So, but you sign a contract to do that. What if in the next contract it said, but you're going to allow sample?
Well, okay, maybe in the next contract. I mean, you know, I mean, that's...
But right now what that means, Don, I think, is it means that they not only have the right to exploit it, but then that gives them the right to protect it as well as you
well,
they had to protect it.
They would see it in very simple terms as they're just protecting their own property, you know.
Right. Yes, I know, and yet it did, and we aren't the only ones. This is happening all over. All these sampling lawsuits have essentially the same effect. They crush an entire work for some 2 or 3 or 4 10-second thing that's within it, and so a whole thing goes down because of this.
I'm not sure. I don't imagine Ireland were upset about the sampling aspect.
Well, they said they were.
Well, but the thing you do in a lawsuit, I mean, they even accused us of defamation of character by associating this foul language with the clean-cut image of the group U2. They did. And we knew that...
Wow.
Well, I think when you have a lawsuit, you throw in every single thing you can think of.
Yeah, probably.
And we thought, actually, if you ever read the actual original lawsuit, it's actually quite funny.
Yeah.
Except for us, but it's actually quite humorous.
I mean, lawyers are a complete different breed, aren't they, really?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
But they're running the show. They are. These lawyers are running the show. They're running these record companies. And
yeah, there's a book. Have you ever heard of the book called Hitmen by Frederick Dannon?
Yes, I have a copy, but I haven't read it yet.
Oh, well, if you ever have the time,
you should
because it's. I've always sort of basically known that the music industry was fairly corrupt, but this book is terrifying.
The artist is a victim, basically, in the music business.
It's kind of like the cannon fodder.
It really is. He's the last guy to know and the last guy to have any recourse. It's these business people have it all their own way, and it's really it's always been that way, and it hasn't gotten any better.
The funny thing is, though, that. And this is what's kind of ironic and kind of annoying about this situation is that Chris Blackwell is kind of, and has always been, the opposite to most major corporate record labels. His style of business is
quite
personal, and it's not at all that kind of cliched thing. Of,
yeah,
have you ever heard of the network?
Mentality and distance and all that. So that's why. The fact that it's Ireland is so kind of annoying and you know.
Yeah. But what's odd is that Timothy Leary has called me up and said, oh, you've got to talk to Chris Blackwell. You've got to meet Chris Blackwell. And Chris Blackwell wants to do things with you. And I know that, you know, he's like this guy who, like, grew up in Jamaica and hung out with all the reggae people and so forth. And it's a weird kind of contradiction. And, you know, I would tell Timothy, well, yeah, I'd like to talk to him, but ask him about this thing with Negative Land, and he would never hear from him.
Yeah, but, you know, I've heard this about Chris Blackwell, too, but, you know, I think even a guy like that is still working under a lot of assumptions about cultural ownership and never even gave it a thought, perhaps like you haven't, that hey, this whole concept of owning private ownership of culture, there's something wrong here. It's too big to ever really... you know, have it occur to you maybe, but But it certainly has occurred to us since this has happened, and we are actually on something of a crusade to bring this issue out and for a public debate and start talking about, wait a minute, what are we doing here? And what are the deleterious effects on culture itself by having it all privately owned to this degree where no one can touch anything else? You know, like, it's an example is folk music. Folk music is dead. It's impossible now because folk music used to be based on basically stealing lyrics and music from previous stuff and incorporating it into what you're doing, and a constant evolving of things based on other things.
Yeah.
And you can't do that today because everything's privately owned. You can't use music or lyrics that exist today because they're privately owned. And so the idea, the very essence of folk music, per se, is impossible now because of this situation.
It's a pretty big thing you're taking on there. You know,
yes.
I mean, there's a lot of, as you say, a lot of money involved. And I think it's pretty clear that in terms of the creative process, if you're sampling momentarily, if you're just borrowing, you know, little sonic things from someone else's piece, and you're creating something completely new, I mean, it shouldn't really be a question of getting permission.
Yeah.
But when you're talking about actual songs and ownership of copyrights and all that, I mean, it's, you know, you're getting into a whole different area, and I don't think that that's going to change.
Well, I think ownership should extend to the entire reuse of the entire work only. In other words, a copyright and ownership of a song means that no one else can use that song or cover that song without paying the artist, because that's the artist's work. That's the entire artist's work.
Yeah.
But like you say, any fragmentary use, I would totally eliminate any concept of ownership. That's
right.
What I would do.
Well, I mean, we've actually suffered in the past ourselves with this, where we got sued for Bono quoting someone else's lyric in a live album of ours.
Really?
At the time, we were actually quite shocked that that the law was so stringent about it. You know, a quotation of one phrase or two phrases was you know, a very big deal, and there was big cash settlement or whatever. So being on the other side of this,
I know it's just a natural artist's inclination, I think, to just use stuff like that. And it is shocking when you find out that you can't even do that.
Yeah,
we
learn pretty quick, though. You know, but I mean, maybe I never questioned it to the extent of saying, "Well, is this right?" I just said, well, this is the situation, so we have to live with it.
No.
whether you've a chance of actually changing it, I don't know. I mean,
I don't think we actually have a real chance, but what we are trying to do in our own very minuscule way is, you know, we just get information out, send out press releases, talk about it, and talking to you was one thing that we thought would be fantastic. You know,
one thing I would say, I mean, I don't know what of this conversation is going to go into the Mondo 2000 interview. If you know, really being fair, you guys at Mondo should talk to Ireland about it, because, you know, my understanding of the sequence of events and what happened is, first of all, it's a bit cloudy because it all happened quite a while ago, but also I wasn't really kept informed very, very much. I just kind of, once every couple of months, I would get the latest installment. Whenever we got a letter from Negative Land asking us to do something, the benefit concert was, I thought, quite an interesting idea.
Well, that was actually our record label's idea, and we thought that was kind of a silly idea. We said, "Well, they're not going to." I mean, we didn't. We by that time we weren't even working with the label anymore, and we thought that our label was doing that mostly as kind of a publicity stunt or something.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it didn't really make any sense.
We were also against the Kill Bono T-shirt. I don't know whether you've known.
Yeah, I like that. I want one.
Well, at the time, it seemed to us that basically, you know, it was SST reacting against U2, and we weren't being sued by U2. We were being sued by Ireland.
Yeah.
But at a certain point, not hearing anything directly from the band, we started thinking, well, you know, where do you draw the line of responsibility here? And And of course, there's been a million unanswered questions, which you've answered a lot of about what happened.
From the MATA 2000 perspective, I'd like to talk to people. In fact, I've tried to.
I've tried to call Eric Levine, and he never returns my calls.
Yeah. But in terms of like setting up this interview, I think if I had said to Paul McGinnis, you may not realize, but you know, two of the members of Negative Land are part of the MATA 2000 staff, and how can we possibly resist this opportunity? He probably would have said, "All right, forget it. The interview's off." So,
don't you think?